in Luke's gospel. He certainly knew how to work a crowd. There was Jesus on his maiden speech in his hometown, Nazareth, and he drops, and everyone's speaking well of him. But then he drops his bombshell. He says, "I tell you the truth," he continued, "no prophet is accepted in his hometown." Talking about himself. "There were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian." So that's a bit of a cliffhanger of an ending. If you know the story, that they weren't exactly rushing to book Jesus to speak at the next event. They took him to the cliff and tried to dispose of him. There's no cliffs near here. So hopefully won't say anything that will cause you to do that this morning. But why the bad ending? Well, this story is a challenging story. And Samuel Gear writes in Working Preacher that this story of the healing of Naaman the Aramean by Elisha the prophet of Israel is a story of border crossing. It's got so much in it, whereby the Lord works in a mysterious way. The story is unwelcome by anyone, ancient or modern, who wants the Lord to observe humanity's boundaries. But it's welcome by those finding themselves at the margin or on the outside. And Jesus is saying in the synagogue there in Nazareth, look, he says, you're just as bad as the people back in the time of Elisha. And God actually sometimes chooses to reach out beyond the boundaries of your thinking. And that period of history was a bad period in Israel's history. The background was they had asked for David the king, we had Solomon, and then many kings after those two, who most of whom were bad. The southern kingdom, Judah, split, and the northern kingdom split. So you had two sets of kings. And most of them, unfortunately, didn't really follow God's ways. And the king at this particular time in the story is probably Joram. And we read in 2 Kings 3 that he did evil in the sight of God. He wasn't as evil as his forefathers, but he did evil, and he wasn't really, he didn't really have a relationship with the living God. So let's look at this passage and see what messages there are for today. Naaman's an interesting guy. His name means pleasantness, actually, in the Hebrew. And I think he probably was a pleasant guy, but he was afflicted with this skin disease, and the word that is used is scourge. It's a very general word. We don't really know exactly what it was, but obviously included things like leprosy. He was a great man in the sight of his master, highly regarded, because the Lord had given him victory, and given victory to Aram, and he was a valiant soldier, but he had this scourge. Now, that was like the HIV/AIDS of the day. Most feared, extremely contagious, incurable, life-limiting disease leading to premature death. And I've spared you this morning putting anything on the overhead projector. I think it would probably be fine for those of you with a medical disposition, but for those of you who are not, it's pretty horrendous. And leprosy in the Bible is often used be synonymous with rejection and with sin and God's punishment. In fact, the word tsaura, which is the Hebrew, means scourge, and it means smitten, stricken. Now, incredibly, if you remember Jesus in Isaiah 53, is a passage that looks forward to him, talks that Jesus is numbered with those who are scourged. In fact, he was scourged for our sins. Now, lepers were put outside the camp. They couldn't come in to worship. And it was a stigma. It was a huge stigma. I remember in Oxford when we were living there some 18, 19 years ago, and one of our house group leader, in fact, was diagnosed with HIV/AIDS. Hemophiliac, and who contracted it through a blood transfusion in the States. And such was the stigma of that at the time that really very, very few people were in on that fact that he was suffering from this, and he subsequently very sadly passed away. And we took communion together, and I have to say to my shame that I was embarrassed and scared and nervous of taking communion. It's back in the 80s, and maybe there was not so much knowledge about the disease at the time. But I was nervous because there was lots of it was basically incurable, and we didn't quite know how it was transmitted. And that was what this disease was like at the time. But Jesus is a man who is a supreme example, who has compassion on these people and would reach out and touch them. And we read about him doing that. Now, in the passage, bands from Aram, that's Syria, had gone out and had taken captive a young girl, a young maiden from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who's in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." I think this is amazing, really, that this girl who's been taken prisoner, really, and is serving this family away from her home. We don't know her name, we don't know much about her, but she knew that there was a God in Israel, and she knew that God could heal this man through this prophet Elisha. I don't know about her, she was obviously compassionate, she was obviously uncomplicated. We can fill in the lines, can't we, when we read these stories. She was faithful, she was loyal. That she knew God, and also she had the courage to speak up. I mean, how often, and I ask myself this question, do we have the courage to speak to those who are very superior to us in our workplaces or wherever, and actually tell them that there is hope in Jesus, and that he can be he is the answer for the world's problems. But we learn about this girl, and she is actually key. Incredibly, some of the commentaries just skip over her. They don't even mention her, but she's key to this story. Her role's pivotal. She's displaced, but she is the one who actually directs this Naaman to the healing power of the Lord. I think, myself, filling in the dots, that Naaman and his family were a good family to work for. I'm sure that she felt valued. I'm sure she felt able to actually speak that word to him. And, of course, she took a real step of faith in doing so. So Naaman went off to his master, the king, and told him what the girl of Israel had said. "By all means," said the king, "go, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So off he went, off goes Naaman, taking with him the talents of silver, the 6,000 shekels of gold, 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king read, "With this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." And again, it's pretty incredible, Naaman's obedience, really, and his response, because he actually listened to this young slave girl, which is incredible in itself. But she's also from the other side. She's from the losing side, as it happens, because Aram has been warring against Israel and have been victorious. And she's going to be sending him to somebody who's vigorously opposed Aram, vigorously opposed the gods of Aram. But, you know, I think when people reach the end of their tether, when they reach the end of their rope, they'll pursue pretty much anything in the course of healing. And I'm sure that this man had reached that point. It reminds me of a story, and again, there's some parallels here. It's not an entirely parallel story, but some of you may be aware of a well-known Christian author called Jennifer Rees-Larkham. And she describes how for 8 years she was in constant pain, increasingly suffering through life-threatening attacks of encephalitis. And she was officially registered disabled, and she was awarded an attendance allowance at the top rate, severe disability, mobility allowances, and medically it was thought that she wasn't going to recover. And in her own words, she says, "As a mother of 6 children, I found this sudden devastating loss of freedom and identity quite ghastly. And the first 2 years of the 8 were a nightmare of depression, guilt and resentment. I believed in God's ability to heal. So, why didn't he? What sin had I committed to cause all this?" And she says, "I sought healing with total determination. My mind became obsessed with this one thing as I consulted everyone with a healing ministry and avidly read their books. This generation worships health and often treats God as a lucky charm. And I certainly did. But he, God, is bigger than that." So that's a bit of her story. And Naaman, desperate, goes cap in hand to the king, and he says yes to the request. And, you know, why did he agree? I mean, Naaman's obviously a very valuable guy to him. He's delivered him victories. But he's taken a risk too. He's sending this guy into enemy territory, and he's sending him with a great deal of money. Now, just out of just curiosity, really, I wanted to find out, what's this money worth in today's terms? A lot of money. One talent of silver is about 34 kilos or whatever that is in pounds, and 10 talents he took with him. Now, in today's prices, that's about £150,000, according to Bloomberg, the other day. So if you've got any silver and you want to trade it in, that's what it's going for. But the gold, even more so, 6,000 shekels is about 70 kilos, and in today's prices, that's around about £2 million worth of gold. So he was, and 10 sets of clothing. I don't know about that, but we know that this guy's going with a great deal. And off he goes with this letter, and something gets lost in translation with this letter, that somehow it comes that the king of Israel is going to heal Elisha. Sorry, Naaman. So Naaman, off he goes, and he has to humble himself before the king. And as soon as the king reads the letter, he tore his robes, and he says, "Oh my God, can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of this leprosy? He's just trying to pick a fight with me." So it's, I don't know about you, sometimes in work I think things are definitely conspiracy going on, you know? Somebody's ganged up, and somebody's got bad intentions here, but I suspect cock-up is more the rationale here. Somebody got it a little bit wrong. He didn't. He kind of missed out Elisha somehow. And the king of Israel's really worried at this point. I mean, he's on the losing side. But he's got to keep honour. What can he do? He knows he can't deliver on the promise. But if he sends this guy back with no answer, well, he's probably going to cop it. So he tears his robes in kind of mourning and fear and all sorts of things. And Elisha hears about this and asks him, "Why have you torn your robes?" So he sent him a message, "Have this man come to me and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger out to him, "Go and wash yourself in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." Well, Naaman went away angry. Now, I'm not really that surprised, to be honest. I don't know if you've ever been on one of those phone calls where you're phoning up the helpline for something or another. I don't know. I won't pick any examples, but I'm sure you've been there. And you hang on for half an hour waiting for somebody, and eventually, after you've navigated the press 1 for this and press 2 for that and 3 if you want to just, I don't know, go away and make yourself a cup of tea, and then eventually you get through to somebody and you think, great, I'm speaking to a human being at long last. And you describe your problem and you go through it all, and they say, "Well, I'm sorry, actually, this is, you've actually come through to the wrong department. We can't help you here. I'm going to have to transfer you back. I'm going to put you on hold just for a moment." And then you go back. The caller, the number you dialed knows you were waiting, or whatever it is, the message, the tune. And I think Naaman had a bit of that, really. He was going around the houses, and he gets sent off to Elisha's house. I'm sure it wasn't as grand as the palace. And Elisha doesn't even give him a personal greeting. He sends his messenger to him, and gives him this simple command. So, pillar to post. And I guess also, if you've ever been on the phone doing this and you've been in pain because you're hurting and you want to get through to somebody and it's not happening for you, let's be honest, we all get cross, don't we? We all get riled. So Naaman, very rich man, of course, and doesn't like to get his bad service. He had in his mind figured out the way that God was going to act. Perhaps with the money he expected some kind of big ceremony. But you know, God seems, and God doesn't operate very often in the way that we expect. His ways, though, are full of wisdom, because he knew what was needed for Naaman in this encounter. He knew the way through to Naaman's heart. And what then if Elisha had come out and actually waved his hands over him? What would have been the outcome? Perhaps Naaman would have thought, "Yeah, Elisha, you know, you're pretty good. Yeah, you're a man of God." And maybe the glory wouldn't go to the right place. And in a sense, maybe he needed to get down and take this simple instruction. Somebody, when I was working many years ago in a church, came to me and said, his chap with mental health problems, and asked for prayer. And I prayed for him, but there was no apparent result. And he told me, your prayers are not good enough. I'm going to go and seek somebody far more powerful. So he went off to the minister of our church, and that was that. There we go. What can I say? It was a bit of a come down, I suppose. But the point is, sometimes we can look in the wrong places, and maybe the guy was, perhaps in this instance, I dare say, looking in slightly the wrong place. But God is God, and He hears. And Naaman's servants come to him and they say, again, this tells us a lot about this guy. I think he's pretty approachable. I mean, would I go up to my boss when he's in a storming rage and say, listen, boss, if he told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more so this simple wash and be clean? So Naaman actually gets on his knees. He does it. He goes and dips himself in the Jordan 7 times. And as he does it, his flesh is restored and clean, like that of a young boy. What has he got to lose, in a way, one could say? But this is interesting, isn't it? And in the Gospels, Jesus tells a story about... In fact, no, it's not a story. Jesus actually has an encounter with 10 lepers. And they come to him, and Jesus says to them, go to the priests and show them that you've been healed. And it says, as they go... they're healed. And there's that kind of step of obedience, isn't there, sometimes, that we can pray and wait for something to happen, but on the other hand, sometimes we actually have to take a step in the right direction. And so as they went, they were healed. I was on the A55 coming back from London the other weekend, and it was 12:30 in the morning, and I was in autopilot, frankly, coming back through Colwyn Bay, 50 mile an hour limits, you know, probably the bit. And I guess I was going a little bit faster than 50, I don't know. It was 12:30 in the morning. And I was just singing through a song in my head, and God seemed to, I believe, spoke to me and said, the greatest honour you can do to me is to keep to the speed limit. Ouch. So I said, okay, Lord, thank you. Why? And so I did, and it was kind of a wake-up call. I've been half asleep in that bit. In fact, there's been times when I've not remembered going through Colwyn Bay, but that's on the hundreds of times I've been through there at the early hours of the morning. But I did, and I stuck to the 50 miles an hour, like, very, very religiously. And as I came through just the middle of that section, somebody ran out through from the side. I've never seen this before, or since. Well, I haven't had much chance to see it since, but I've never seen it before. Somebody ran out from the side and, actually sauntered out, to be frank. They sauntered in front of the car. It was, it was a couple of hundred yards in front of me. Could I have hit them? I don't know. But I was certainly very much more aware of my driving. And it's just a stupid thing, really. But you know, who knows what might have happened if I'd been on autopilot through that section. So I was glad to have stuck to the speed limit. At least I didn't get a ticket anyway, which is a good thing. So Naaman and his attendants, they have this. He has this cleansing and this healing, and he goes back to the man of God. And he stands before him and says, now that I know there is no God in the world except for in Israel, and please accept now a gift from your servant. That's interesting. He's now Elisha's servant. It's an interesting word. And if we remember from Jesus' story that there was only one leper that actually came back and said, thank you. And Jesus said, rise and go. And that leper is actually a Samaritan, so it was a foreigner. Jesus says to him, rise and go. Your faith has made you well. All of them were cured, but just one of them was truly restored, I believe. And the prophet answered, as surely as the Lord lives whom I serve, before whom I stand, I will not accept a thing. And Naaman urges stuff on him, but he won't take it. He won't take it in this instance. So what does he do? Naaman, I think, wants to remember this experience. So he says, give me a pile of earth to take back with me. And I will never again worship the god of Aram, which is Rimmon. But forgive me, Lord, will you forgive me because I have to go in with my master into the temple. And when he bows down, would you forgive me of this? And a lot of commentators really do seem to have got their theological underpants in a twist over this section. So why does Elisha allow him to do this? Isn't taking the soil a bit like encouraging some kind of superstitious approach to his newfound faith? And why doesn't he forbid him from bowing down to the temple of Rimmon? Well, I don't know. Who am I to guess why he did this? But sometimes, you know, I find myself in my own walk with God, I need physical things to remind me of things that God has done. It can't be just in the head. Sometimes I think we would have a faith that's just all up there. But in having a thing, in having something, in having this earth, maybe it was a reminder for this guy that God is the God of Israel is the God of all the earth. And it was a reminder. And after all, the Israelites would set up stones and memorial places, and there are examples of that in the Old Testament. And, you know, the other thing is God takes us one day at a time, doesn't he? This guy has just met with the living Lord. And God is ever so compassionate and gentle with us. And he takes us one step at a time. And Elisha speaks the word to him, now go in peace, he says. He doesn't say yes or no, but he gives him a kind of a blessing. He leaves it up, I suggest, to Naaman and his newfound God. God takes us on a journey. And you know, we were hearing, I think, earlier on about Muslim lands and those of us from here who work in Muslim lands. And you know, there are, in Muslim lands now, secret believers, people who believe in Isa, in Jesus, but yet, because of their position, because of their status or whatever, it's extremely costly and very difficult for them to come out as a believer in Jesus. And so they, at the stage where they are with the Lord at that time, they may be still going to the mosque, but they're praying to a different God. So we see in this story then a simple slave girl's testimony. She could have so easily just kept quiet. We see as well this obedience of Naaman. We see that God is able to break into this situation and moves in a most powerful way. And it's amazing, isn't it, actually? I really thought about this as in reflecting on this passage. Is what does Elisha send back into Aram, into Syria, to the, if you like, the left-hand, right-hand man of the king? He sends back a cleansed, this is a testimony to God. He sends back a man who's been cleansed, but he sends back a believer into that scenario. You can't, and no one will be able to say, no, God didn't act in that way. So God, the God of surprises. And as I finish now, we're just reminded of Jesus. Because we see in Jesus what God is like in the flesh, his character, his compassion. And we see that in Jesus, he reached out to those who were scourged by society, those who were on the outside. He actually numbers himself with them. He consistently identified himself with them for whatever reason, those who are outside the camp, those who are not in the club. John 6:37 says, all that the Father who gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me I will never drive away. And Isaiah 53, which was I referred to, written 700 years before Christ, looks forward to him and says, he was despised and rejected by men. He, a man of sorrows, was this Jesus, familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hid their faces. He was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities, our sicknesses, and he carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken, smitten, leprous, if you like, by God, and afflicted. He was pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities, and the punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds, by his scourging, we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray, and each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has laid on him the punishment of us all. So this is Jesus, the Good Shepherd. But what about the story of Jennifer Rees-Larkham that I started with, I mentioned earlier on, who was confined to a wheelchair with a life-limiting, really life-terminating illness? Well, there's some parallels here in her story with this. She says, I was actually speaking at a meeting in my wheelchair. I felt sure for 3 months that God was about to heal me and would send someone out of the blue to confirm this conviction and then pray for me. I did not ask for it or seek it. It was simply his time. A young girl who had only been a Christian for a few months suddenly stood up as the meeting was closing and said she felt God wanted her to say, "I was going to be healed." I knew inside that this was the person for whom I'd been waiting. And when the meeting was over, I asked her to pray for me, as many gathered around us. She was most reluctant, never having done such a thing before. Her hands shook with fear, and she did not use any of the right words the healing books say that should be used. I wasn't slain in the spirit, and I don't think that I did any of the right things either, yet God healed me, and I stood up instantly. She says, "Surely healing, like all God's gifts, is not earned or deserved." No one, to my knowledge, was storming heaven when the wonderful thing happened to me. Perhaps I would have preferred him not to do it quite so publicly. But that's our God, who moves in mysterious ways, who uses the courageous testimony of a young girl, and in this instance a young Christian, and who moves in his way and in his time. And we can come, and we can come this morning in obedience to Jesus. And he will meet our needs. He may not deal with them in the way that we expect, but he's always ready and willing and interceding for us. That's our Jesus. That's our God. He is wonderful. He is available. And he is near. He is just a heartbeat away. So let's just give him thanks as we move into this next part of our service, which is remembering how he gave his body for us on the cross.